This is April 28, 2007, and I am recording Tom Copeland in Bellingham. Okay, so Tom, we don't have to speak loud. You don't have to do anything. This is my kind of interview. High quality rig here. So tell me what your
Let me go back to what I was saying before. You know, the oil spill has been well documented. Most of us have told our stories several times over the years. You know, and I certainly had nothing against RCAC making sure that the people. It's covered again, mm-hmm. but I think the thing that's being missed here is the story of RCAC and its founding and stuff, because of course it came directly out of the oil spill, and I think it's proven to be a spectacularly successful model of how to deal with a major problem with polluting industries that pose a huge risk for the environment, but yet that we feel necessary. And the answer is through legislation to insist that those people who are putting the public at risk and making a profit at it contribute to informed citizen review of their activities, which is what RCAC is. We get $3 million a year from the Alaskan oil industry in order to oversee their operations. We don't have any jurisdiction other than we have funding, guaranteed independence, and the same access that regulatory agencies have to inspect their facilities and operations and stuff. We're just strictly a jawboning operation, but that's been enough. It's made a tremendous difference. Anybody who goes through the post Exxon Valdez history of oil transportation in Alaska will realize what a huge positive force informed local citizen activism has been, stabilizing and improving the system. And I think it's night and day. And I don't think that there's much doubt about that in the local communities. I mean, we're perceived as being very successful and having created a very successful and safe oil transportation system, which is certainly minimizing the danger of having another Exxon Valdez, which is what everybody sought for. And I think it should serve as a model for other industries which have a large footprint on the public domain, and as a way to control their activities. And I think the word needs to get out that this has been done. Outside of Alaska, nobody knows about it. And B, that it's been so dramatically successful. So that would be my pitch. If I was going to write a book, if RCAC was going to spend money on writing a book, it ought to be about themselves and about their early history, which has not been adequately documented and covered. Mm-hmm. So I'll throw that out as a...
Okay. Well, just to reassure you...
I realize that's not this project.
Well, I think that bits and pieces about the establishing of RCAC and its... mission is going to leak out, because Joe had quite a bit to say about RCAC.
Yeah, I'm sure he did.
So, and we'll get your piece in there as well. So maybe we'll be addressing two things at the same time. But so tell me about your relationship with Alaska and the oil spill. You were fisherman.
You
were
start
fisherman.
At the beginning?
Yeah, you were a fisherman.
I was. I've been fishing in Prince William Sound since 1963. My family comes from Tucson, Arizona, and we pioneered our way up there in 1963.
Mm-hmm.
My dad and mom decided that they needed to show the kids the last remaining chunk of wilderness before we all grew up, so we all moved up there. I was the oldest child. I was just graduated from high school. And my younger brother and I, who was a freshman in high school at the time, went fishing with my father on the Copper River Flats the year before the earthquake. And as pure Chechakos, we'd done a little boating in Mexico before, but we'd never actually, certainly not done anything for commercial fishing before. And went out on the flats and we survived. And, you know, we did all the various fisheries. Cordova's renowned for having all of the different kinds of fisheries in Alaska, and everyone does them all, which is different from the rest of Alaska. The rest of Alaska, commercial fishing, you're either a gill netter, or you're a seiner, or you're a troller, or you're a longliner, but you tend to do only one type of fishing. Mm-hmm. In Cordova, that's not true. Everybody dabbles in all of the various types of fishing, except for trolling, which we don't have. Well, you want to, we'll just keep going here.
So anyway,
the next, my 1 year was enough for my dad, and so the family moved back to Arizona, and in 60, that was 62, in 60, no, 63, in 64, the year of the earthquake, that 63, 64 winter, my younger brother and I built two skiffs down in Tucson, loaded them on a flatbed truck and drove up the Alcan in the spring, which turned out to have been a month after the big Alaska earthquake, which changed everything in Prince William Sound, and more specifically on the Copper River Flats, the ancestral fishing grounds of Cordova, and which was all only about 12 feet deep where people fished, and it rose 6 feet in the earthquake, so now it was only 6 feet deep. Half of the water had left the flats, mm-hmm. and gotten even shallower, so it was a completely changed fishery the spring that Steve and I started. So everybody, to a certain extent, we were part of a big new era on the Copper River Flats in particular, but also in Prince William Sound. A lot of the traditional fishing areas had either risen or collapsed vertically and had destroyed the fish resource. So it was a completely changed commercial fishing situation. Cordova didn't suffer much physical damage, but its fishing grounds suffered mightily. Sort of the same thing had happened 25 years later to the day in the Exxon Valdez oil spill. We didn't get any oil on us down in Cordova, but our fishing grounds took the biggest hit of all. And yet we find ourselves overshadowed by other groups of fishermen downstream from Prince William Sound who were actually more physically oiled in their communities, but who didn't suffer nearly the economic effects that Cordova suffered. So it's been a kind of an ironic situation for Cordova. It's tucked up well enough onto the west side of Prince William Sound that it doesn't directly get hit with oil spills, but it certainly was turned almost into a ghost town by the Exxon Valdez.
Cordova
was, yeah. And many of the other ironies, of course, are that Cordova has by far the best airport in Prince William Sound. We have the only scheduled jet, at the time, in 1989, we had the only scheduled daily jet service in Prince William Sound. And yet, during the Exxon Valdez oil spill, not 1 ounce of oil response equipment was unloaded at that fabulous airport in Prince William Sound. Every bit of equipment that was flown in, which was most of whatever showed up, was flown into the itty-bitty little mountain-ringed airport in Valdez, because Valdez was the center of the response. It was the oil town. You know, our bested rival, we had whipped Valdez into nothingness for 50 years prior to the oil company showing up, and they rebuilt this ghost town of Valdez into the biggest town in Prince William Sound. And so the only thing that anybody cared about were Valdez effects. Well, the point of the matter is Valdez profited from the oil spill. You know, the money ended up in Valdez, and they don't care about the fishing grounds of Prince William Sound other than a highway to drag their oil through. So there's a lot of bitterness about the difference between Cordova and Valdez and the oil spill. Cordova suffered the oil spill and Valdez profited, and it has not been portrayed that way in the media. And it's one of the reasons why one of the biggest fights we had within RCAC over the first 6 to 8 years was relocating the main staff and office to Valdez. That was very unpopular with all of the other communities who made up the board of RCAC because of this story I just told you. Everyone is well aware that Valdez profited from the oil industry itself and then greatly from the oil spill itself.
So relocating from where?
Anchorage is where the RCAC was organized and ran for the first 8 years or so. We had our main office, almost all of our personnel were in Anchorage, and very particularly for the reason that we didn't want to move into an oil town and be influenced by the politics of an oil town. But it became more and more apparent as time went on that one of the lessons citizens learn when they're well-financed and organized is that you get the main bang for your buck when you work with very low echelon people within the industry. Mm-hmm. By the time, what we need to do is when there's a project started in the terminal or with the transportation system, we need to talk to that guy who's first been tasked with scoping out the project. And we need to influence that person before he puts anything on paper. Mm-hmm. Because it's much too late to change the course of a project once it hits the president of Alyeska's desk and in Anchorage, and then we'd walk in and say, "Oh, you got it all wrong," blah blah blah, blah, right. blah, right? And we were not nearly as effective in making our voice heard until we actually moved most of the office staff down to hated Valdez, mm-hmm. and just because of the force of necessity. I mean, you know, it became apparent to everyone, almost everyone, mm-hmm. that we needed to do that. But it was one of the hardest decisions we ever made, was to move our main focus into Valdez.
So how effective would it have been, or would it have been possible to have branches of RCAC in all of the spilled communities?
Nothing for it to do. It never made any sense. We toyed with that idea for a short period of time, but in reality, our job was to make sure there was no need for public relations in all of the downstream communities. The only reason we'd ever want a small office in each of those communities was if we had another Exxon Valdez spill. And our job was to prevent that, not capitalize on the future oil spills. So it never made any sense to do it. I think we toyed with it for a year or two and spent a little bit of money in that direction. But the only reason to have those would be during a subsequent spill. Mm-hmm. And we all felt that we could stop future oil spills from happening, and that's mm-hmm. what's always been our focus, is prevention. I have been the odd guy out on the board and in the committees for years by focusing my efforts in response. I'm interested in oil spill response, not particularly in oil spill prevention. Mm-hmm. My organization, of course, is primarily interested in oil spill prevention. Mm-hmm. So I found myself involved in a lot of oil spill prevention disputes over the years, but my focus has always been on what do you do once the oil is on the water, mm-hmm. and how do we avoid the most searing event in my life, which was the 2 weeks right after the Exxon Valdez spilled the oil, when nothing was done by anyone. It was very clear from day one or two that Exxon had no real plans to actively go in and clean up the oil. They were counting on Mother Nature to blow it down to Japan. Mm-hmm. And in all likelihood, that was a good gamble. It's early spring in March and early April in Prince William Sound is a fairly violent time for weather. And they could count on a big storm coming up that would push the oil out in the Gulf of Alaska, and where they would at least have a better excuse for not doing anything with it. And letting it naturally weather was a nice line of theirs early on. But it almost makes you believe in God, the preternatural, beautiful series of days and weeks that we had right after the oil was spilled. It was just like today, mm-hmm. for in Prince William Sound, for 6 long agonizing weeks. Day after sunny, beautiful day, while the oil soaked deeper into the beaches and washed in and out with the tides, and it was unbelievable. And it just drove people insane, myself included. I flew up the...
Let me ask you this, Tom. It drove you insane because nothing was being done, because the weather was making the problem worse?
The weather had refused to cooperate in this notion that they would blow the oil out of Prince William Sound, okay. and where it couldn't be reasonably captured, and in fact stayed in Prince William Sound for weeks. Mm-hmm. And eventually part of it left, And but half of it stayed behind forever. And and it was just maddening to see, to know that we could, for the first, well, let me back up here for a while.
Okay.
I flew up on day four. Mary and I were planting the apple orchard down here at the time. And Bill Black, the person we just talked to on the phone, drove out to give us the news that, that there was a huge oil spill in Prince William Sound. So I handed Mary the shovel, literally, and said, I'll see you when I see you, and went down and jumped on a plane and flew up right away. And I was a board member of CDFU at the time. Cordova Fishermen District United, the local fishermen's union, the oldest fishing union still extant on the West Coast, as a matter of fact. And I had fought my way back onto the board on the anti-logging ticket at that time. And I was mainly an activist in reviewing the Forest Service plan for Prince William Sound and stuff. But I was on the board, so I felt I needed to get up there and try to make commercial fishermen a part of the response. Well, when we got up there, it became apparent that nothing was happening and nothing was likely to happen. In the first 10 days of the oil spill, Exxon switched its responsible party four times. They had four different people come in to take over the spill. And not only, just about the time you'd get that guy educated enough to where he was calling back east saying, hey, we better do something, they'd replace him with another guy who needed to get 3 or 4 days of indoctrination before he ran out of excuses for doing nothing. And then they'd send the next guy in. They did that four times. And meanwhile, the Coast Guard refused to take responsibility. The Coast Guard, at that time, before Open 90, the Coast Guard was supposed to manage the responsible party's response, but it was the responsible party's responsibility to actually go out there and cause the response to happen. The Coast Guard was only supposed to be there in kind of a safety regulatory overseeing, but the Coast Guard was very adamant from the start that it was not their responsibility to respond to this oil spill. It was Exxon's, and they refused. And it turned out Bill Black came up with me and was manning the phones. The day three, some fishermen who just without any orders at all had gone out and helped tow boom around the Exxon Valdez while it was still on the reef. And the Baton Rouge, which was starting to, the one part of Exxon's response that was very professionally, as near as I can tell, accomplished, was the lightering. And a very interesting person for you to talk to would be the official RCAC hero of the oil spill, which was, it'll come to me. Bill Deppe, who was an Exxon skipper, tanker skipper, who was charged with the lightering of the Exxon Valdez. They flew him up from wherever he was, and he got the Exxon Baton Rouge alongside the tanker in a minimum amount of time. It was there within 24, 36 hours, a very quick move anyway. And it was very a dangerous thing. The Exxon was sitting on the reef with its bottom torn off. And they had to bring another tanker of slightly shallower draft in and tie up alongside it. So there was only a very finite number of feet underneath the hull of the Baton Rouge as they're pumping her full of oil. And lowering her draft. So she was coming down on top of the reef at the same time that they could have easily left two tankers up on top of that reef if a storm had come up or any number of things. It could have been a very critical operation. But in fact, they successfully lightered 75% of the oil off of the Exxon Valdez. Thank God. And as near as I can tell, there's some critics of what's her name? Ricky Ott disputes the amount of oil that was actually taken off. Mm. And there's some evidence for the fact that perhaps they only got 60% of the oil rather than 75%. But hey, we're thankful.
Right.
We're very thankful.
Right.
And Bill Deppe did a superb job of accomplishing that mission. And he was later our favorite Exxon liaison person for 8 years at RCAC. He did two tours of duty with us as an Exxon representative. And it went a long way to healing a number of the wounds, which have mostly reopened since he's left. But
He's a defector. Oh, good.
A what?
He's a defector.
Oh, no, not of Exxon. They just, he's had new assignments finally after 8 years.
Well, but, that's good too, though.
But he'd be a great person to talk to. And he's, and I, on, when he left, I made an official proclamation passed through the board of RCAC to make him the hero of the oil spill from our point of view. He's the guy that picked up most of the oil, thank God. And but anyway, Bill Black manned the phones, and anyway, these guys came in. One of them came in who had been trying to drape this chicken shit boom that Exxon had, that Alyeska had, trying to hold it together around the tanker in some sort of, you know, containment. And it kept breaking, and it was just junk. It was rotten, and, you know. And finally, one of the guys from the Baton Rouge leaned over. It was probably Bill Deppy. I don't know this for a fact, but anyway, somebody leaned over and yelled, "Hey, what you guys ought to get is some of that Navy boom. The Navy's got the boom you need." So this guy ran back into town and told Bill Black about it, CDFU. And so Bill got on the phones, and his wife down here got on the phones and spent, in told, hundreds of dollars calling around trying to find this boom. And in fact, they finally got a hold of the base commander back in New Jersey that had both the boom and the skimmers, 30 Marco Class 3 skimmers, loaded on C5 Alphas and had them loaded up since day one. And this was like 10 days into the spill by the time Bill and Rose found them. And
to say what you mean.
Hope the tape was not.
It wasn't. It wouldn't matter anyway. Okay.
So and the problem turned out to be that the Coast Guard refused to add. The Navy had to be asked by the Coast Guard to send this equipment to the oil spill. They were perfectly willing to send it. The Navy was,
but they had
from
to go
day
to the
one.
Coast Guard.
But the Coast Guard had to say, "Please send this equipment," and it was the chain of command. And the Coast Guard was refusing to do so. It was Exxon's problem, not the U.S. government's problem. It was Exxon's problem. And unfortunately, Exxon couldn't ask the Navy for the boom and the skimmers. It was government equipment, right? Not private equipment. The government had to ask for it. And so we called everybody and raised hell, called all the senators and everybody. And finally, we got it 3 weeks into the oil spill. 3 weeks it took, and the Coast Guard never did ask for it. What happened was that I met the fellow who walked in to President Bush's office at the White House and said, "Sir, we have to send that equipment, that Navy equipment has to go, whether the Coast Guard will ask for it or not. We have to send it." And Bush said, "Okay, send it." And so he ordered the direct presidential order to send the Navy equipment to Prince William Sound. Coast Guard never would ask for it. Never did ask for it. If we'd gotten that equipment 2 weeks earlier, the spill would have been a whole different story. I mean, it wasn't a lot of equipment, but it was some equipment. We could have made a difference. That was the problem with the first 2 weeks of the oil spill. Nothing was done. Not one damned thing. They dropped some piss-tested rock wipers on Smith Island to wipe the rocks, but the oil was out all over the water and coming back in, so they'd no sooner get something wiped and it'd be oiled the next day. They could wipe the same rock every day, you know, and they were getting a smidgen of oil with their soak-up pads. That's the oil that was being recovered for the first 2 weeks. Exxon had no equipment, Alyeska had no equipment, and the Navy equipment couldn't be accessed because the Coast Guard didn't want to take responsibility for federalizing the spill. And they were probably correct. Exxon probably would have walked away entirely. It's the first time the Coast Guard lifted up the phone and said, "Send that equipment," Exxon would have said, "Okay, we're out of here, back to New Jersey." But probably what would have happened, you know. And so that's the kind of politics that were swirling around. And you know, we were focused on it. Cordova, in particular, was focused on it. Believe me, the whole town was mobilized, you know.
Okay, let me break in here to ask you something that keeps tweaking me is, having lived in Alaska for a substantial period of time and having gotten around a number of communities, never having gotten to Cordova, I keep flashing on the isolation, the geographical isolation of Cordova, which is of course relative, but nevertheless, you guys in Cordova were rather isolated, except for flights in and out, so forth.
Well, we weren't isolated in any respect, except you couldn't drive there.
Well,
you can't call us isolated when we have the only daily jet scheduled flights in all of Prince William Sound, including okay. It was much easier to get to Cordova both before and during the oil spill than any other community affected by it, because we have the only daily jet service from Anchorage.
Okay, well, that's probably good.
So it's not. You can't call us isolated. See, that's the problem. That's what Exxon and the state, everybody kept saying, oh, you're so isolated over here, so isolated. We're not isolated over there. Mm-hmm. We're not isolated at all. That's not true.
Yeah.
What is true is that he didn't want to use the airport. You know, they didn't want to use the airport because, gee, they wouldn't have been able to hang out in the oil town. They'd had to come to the fishing town. That was the problem. Mm-hmm. And Exxon isn't going to voluntarily. Exxon made the mistake of flying a few guys down to Kodiak a week after the spill, and they were lucky to get out with their lives. You know, Exxon didn't just traipse around to the other communities. Forget it, man. They were lynched. You know, they'd been lynched. The only place they were safe was in Valdez.
Okay.
And that was, I think, the primary motivation. And the other one was the media. The media was entirely short-sighted and focused on Valdez. They thought they were in the middle of the wilderness and super isolated when they got to goddamn Valdez.
Yeah.
You know, oh, man, you see these guys, they show up, they're still tearing the labels off their fresh new Levi's that they bought for this trip. You know, the Exxon guys had them starched and ironed with a crease in them, their Levi's. You know, I mean, it was a culture clash, you know. And so
you guys, here you guys are sitting in Cordova.
We're sitting in Cordova going goddamned insane, tearing at each other's throats. You know, the Coast Guard's first duty with Cordova, the first thing the Coast Guard did with Cordova was make sure that every fishing vessel owner in Cordova knew that if they left the harbor with their boat, they would never be allowed in another federally funded harbor anywhere in the world. They would be a boat without a harbor. They would be denied any access to federal harbors forever. So don't even think about going out in Prince William Sound and trying to do something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you'd be the man without a port.
Yeah.
And that was the Coast Guard's position, to just stay out of the goddamn way. You know, well, we stayed out of the goddamn way for two long, hot, sunny, stinky weeks, hearing tales, no good tales, were coming back from either Valdez. We had a contingent in Valdez right away. The president of the union was up there working with Exxon Logistics right away, trying to coordinate something, but nothing was happening. He'd spend 3 days educating the Exxon muckety-muck on local geography and the talents of the oil and the commercial fishing industry and how many boats we had, et cetera, which none of the Exxon guys appeared to believe. You know, they couldn't believe that there were thousands of boats in South Central Alaska. That, in fact, we were a maritime culture, and that we could certainly go out there and house 10,000 people tonight safely on the water, you know, and feed them a gourmet meal to boot. You know, there wasn't a, you know, Exxon was totally, once they got started, when Bush, about the time he ordered the Navy stuff sent, he also told Exxon in no uncertain terms that, hey, we want a response. We expect a response out of you guys. This was like day 20 of the oil spill, day 18 or 19 of the oil spill, when Bush finally issued his proclamation and said, you will perform a massive cleanup in South Central Alaska and get after it, boys.
Mm-hmm.
It's only going to get worse. And so Exxon at that point made a big, oh, of course we are. Sure we are. It's unbelievable and difficult. That is. You know, and finally turned around and started focusing on doing something, in which for them, of course, meant how do we get 10,000 bunks and mess halls and everything out in the middle of this godforsaken wilderness? And of course, CDFU had been telling them for 2 weeks that, just give us the word. Take the locks off the harbor, and we'll all drive out there. We put tens of thousands of people on the water. We'd be out there right now, except for you guys. You know, let's just go out there and do it. There's nothing hard about it, you know, but it took another month to get revved up, you know. And by that time, the oil was all down by Kodiak and Kathmandu, you know. And such it was. It wasn't all down there, and we actually picked up quite a bit in Prince William Sound. But anyway, by the end of 2.5 weeks, we'd torn each other apart in Cordova, you know, fishermen or not. We're kind of different from farmers, I think. I don't know, maybe farmers are the same way, but we don't clump up very easy. you know, and they were tend to be fairly individualistic, mm-hmm. and we all had our different ideas on what a proper response to this calamity was. Mm-hmm. And
so there was no fishing, there was no cleanup, there was no...
There was nothing. Nothing went on except a lot of hot air.
Yeah.
You know, and finally the state, you know, the state was as much part of it as anybody else. They'd approved these non-existent stockpiles of equipment and everything. They were as culpable as any. They were, in fact, more culpable than any other party. Well, the Coast Guard had its own... Are you aware that the actual cause of the oil spill was not the drunken skipper? But was, in fact, the radar operators not watching the radars that night? Are you aware of that?
Well, I've been told by...
The National Transportation Safety Studies points it out very distinctly. It's an official document of the U.S. government. And their finding was that, drunk as he was, Hazelwood did the right thing that night mm-hmm. in calling up the Coast Guard and telling them that he was leaving the normal tanker lanes in order to avoid ice. And they were all sitting around in that room playing cards or something because no one bothered to look at the radar. They claimed over and over again that their radars were inadequate. Well, the radars weren't inadequate. They didn't ever switch the range knob. They played cards while the Exxon Valdez, after notifying them that it was leaving the tanker, normal tanker lanes on a very icy night to avoid the ice, never bothered to change the range knob, so he drove off their screen. And that was what happened. No one was paying attention at the Coast Guard radar control, the traffic control center.
And this is this.
And it's in the National Transportation Safety Study. It's testified under oath. The whole thing. That was the proximate cause of the oil spill. Was Coast Guard inattention to the working, functioning radars?
That's the reason that this book could potentially be very important because.
That's why we got OpenIDE. That's why we have RCAC.
Yeah.
Is precisely that. A number of us went back to D.C. in 89 and 90 and told a number of congressmen this very story
mm-hmm.
and said, we can't trust the Coast Guard. You can pass all the laws making the Coast Guard responsible for oil spills from now on, which OpenIDE did. They are now responsible. Once it gets over a certain size, the Coast Guard has to take over immediate responsibility for the cleanup. That was a main change of OpenIDE because of this two-week delay. In fact, forever delay. They never did take over. And the Coast Guard.
Mm-hmm.
And
but you're saying open...
OpenIDE, Oil Pollution Act of 1990.
Okay, OpenIDE. Okay,
the first
90.
OpenIDE. Okay. The first Oil Transportation Safety Act ever passed by the federal government.
Okay.
1990. But a number of fishermen were back there telling the legislators... that this was not enough, this was not sufficient, because it was the Coast Guard that had caused the oil spill.
Yeah.
The Coast Guard was not paying attention to what was going on. You know, they had complacency ruled that night in Valdez's arm, and we couldn't allow that to happen again, and the only way we could think to not have it happen was to have local citizens in charge. We're the only ones who care.
Right.
You know, the oil industry doesn't care about oil spills. Hell, it's just another career move for them.
Yeah.
And likewise for the Coast Guard and everybody else. You know, they just don't want to get their shoes oily.
Yeah.
You know, and the only people who really can be trusted to pay attention year in and year out and stay focused on it are the guys whose property and lifestyle are going to be destroyed.
Yeah.
And us, you know, Cordovans.
Right.
You know, Prince William Sound, Kodiak,
yeah.
Seward, Saluia.
Yeah.
And we were, by God, we got it. We got a great section in OpenIDE dictating both our RCAC and the Cook Inlet RCAC and at minimum funding levels. And we've proven to be... Hi, Sarah.
Okay, let me just...
Exxon Valdez stuff, you know.
Okay. All right. So... So can you remember where we were? Can you pick up from there?
Yeah. So, anyway, things were getting pretty pretty brutal in Cordova by mm-hmm. this. We were like too many rats locked up. We aren't used to being locked up in our port by the Coast Guard, right? And you couldn't go anywhere. You had no excuse but the politics. So even the real fishermen, the guys who never had time for the union or anybody, you know, they were the highliners, right? They were too busy killing things to do any politics. Even those guys couldn't be out there doing their normal stuff. They had nothing to do but come up and complain to CDFU about how nothing was happening. Well, right, nothing was happening, right? Well, 2 weeks of that was plenty. And on my birthday, April 7th, 1989, I hit the great idea. You know, I was just totally frustrated, going out of my mind and with everybody else. And I finally decided that the problem was that we were all trying to do something in unison. And in reality, the only way to attack this oil appeared to be on an individual basis. It was my mental hygiene that I was concerned about. Mm-hmm. You know, I was going nuts. Mm-hmm. I was going to do something. I was going to pick up the AK-47 and, you know,
right.
There were a lot of people talking about scoped rifles as the answer and all this stuff. You know, it was getting pretty wild. And so I hit upon the notion that I just needed to go get my share of the oil, right? And just for my own personal benefit. And I was walking out of Cordova outboard and spied this little 1-inch air powered diaphragm pump for fuel transfers. It was, you know, we move a lot of gasoline around from boat to boat, and it's notorious for causing explosions and fires. And with the electricity, you know, driving the pump. So this was an air-powered pump. It was an air-powered diaphragm transfer pump. A little miniature thing, you know, cost $800. And I said, wow, that's my birthday present. I'm going to go. The diaphragm pumps will pump anything. You know, it doesn't matter the viscosity. It'll pump mud, you know. And I said, I can pump some oil with that. You know, I don't care what it looks like. So I went, you know, and we all had thousands of 5-gallon buckets in town, because we were normally this time of the year we'd be kelping, which involved picking up herring roe on kelp and salting it in the 5-gallon buckets and selling it to the Japanese. So there were tens of thousands of 5-gallon buckets in town, and so I rounded up a crew and headed out. Regardless of what the Coast Guard was saying, you know, they clearly were impotent, and I didn't care whether I came back or not, you know. And so I grabbed a couple of friends and off we went on the first bucketeering trip, which is what these pictures are from.
Here. Oh, okay.
Yeah, we got up in the that's Northwest Bay on the northern tip of Night Island. Now we wandered around out there for a day or so, and got Exxon had a number of people and boats on the water by then. They just didn't have any skimmers. They didn't have any way to pump the oil up. So we went to Herring Bay, was the favorite place in the world. The worst of the oil was, supposedly. So we ran around in the Herring Bay, which is also on Night Island, and it was full of oil, all right. And there were several chartered boats in there by then, and there was some boom that they had boomed up quite a bit of the oil with. And which is the booms full of oil were just floating around in the middle of bigger amounts of oil. And so we went over there and stuck our little diaphragm pump and tied up to one of these circular booms and stuck the diaphragm pump over the side and started pumping. And by God, it worked. You know, we were pumping into this, here. It had a tote on the back deck, and this little hose is coming in, and we were pumping off the water into this. Tote on the back deck of Janus Inn, and then we'd siphon. This was a siphon hose, you know, coming off, taking the water back out off the bottom.
God, that must have felt good to finally be doing something.
Oh, it was fabulous. See this picture here? This is the very first morning with this setup. You see, that's that same tote sitting there behind me.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And look at the crew here, man. The first time it's just started working, I mean, this is the first morning. Look at that. They were ecstatic. We've gotten a lot of hell for that picture because they looked too happy, you know. Well, believe me, we were happy.
Yeah.
We were ecstatic. Man, we'd actually made a difference. That's more oil than anyone had picked up on that. That's day 17 of the oil spill. And that's the majority. On day 17, I'll bet you that's the majority of all the oil that had been containerized from the Exxon Valdez. That's 100 buckets we did. that day, 500 gallons, and I bet it's the first 500 gallons that was picked up. I can't prove that. Mm-hmm. It was about the time the Navy skimmers were starting to show up in town. It was it was simultaneous with Exxon finally having some sort of actual oil presence out there, mm-hmm. and responding. But I bet this was the first.
Wow.
And I had a good friend, one of my fishing partners, Floyd Hutchins, was a very able fisherman, and he was out in the middle of in front of Prince William Sound on the day of the oil spill in a longliner, longlining for halibut. And over the first 12 hours or so, he realized one of the big problems was that no one could communicate. There were not repeater stations at that time for VHF radio in Prince William Sound. So the Exxon officials in Valdez couldn't talk to the tanker. They couldn't talk to any of the reconnaissance boats that were downstream. And a few aspects of the Alyeska oil plant did sort of work. And one of the best ones was Clean Seas, the North Slope response organization, immediately trucked several thousand feet of boom on flatbed trucks down to Valdez and got them on a landing craft and went out and tried to do some protective booming downstream of the Exxon Valdez. But they didn't have enough personnel to man the booms. And one of the lessons we learned right away was you never leave a boom untended. If you put a boom out and leave, it's worthless. It ends up hanging from the trees within a day or two. And northern Prince William Sound was festooned with thousands and thousands of feet of boom laying up at the high tide mark, doing absolutely no good, but it was out there. It was a resource to be used. And about the time we pumped about, just a bucket. We didn't even bucket any of the stuff down in Herring Bay before the Exxon guys showed up and ran us off. This was their oil. They'd boomed it up. It was their oil. They didn't need any help. Get the hell out of here. And besides, you're not legal. You know, you're not supposed to be out here. All this stuff. But they said, hey, we hear one of them came up to me and said, hey, I think there's a lot of oil up in Northwest Bay. And there's nobody up there. I said, okay, I'm out of here, man. And so I ran up there. And sure enough, the whole bay was full of oil. And we had it to ourselves. And so this is in Northwest Bay, which about an hour from Herring Bay. And as you can see, there was a boom across the top of the bay up here. Mm-hmm. And it's still there. You can see it right there. Mm-hmm. It was originally... But the tide, you know, they had it strung from side to side. In that case, it stayed up there. But every low tide, it stretched and opened up a big hole between it and the beach. And then this river of oil would come running out. Mm-hmm. And so we got in the river of oil. This oil is moving about half a knot. It was about an inch thick coming down this beach there. And we put a Zodiac out in it and started pumping away. There's a picture of the whole operation here. This is my. Anyway, these are. Where was that one? Here it is. This one. You can see we had a crewman in a Zodiac with the little diaphragm pump, and he was just pumping away. We didn't even have this boomed up. It was thick enough coming down that beach that we could just. Stick the hose over the side and pump it away, and then we'd pump up onto the deck, and we had an air compressor running this thing, and pump and fill up the tote, and then we'd siphon the water off the bottom, and then start brailing with flour scoops the oil out of this tote and into the buckets, and here we are scooping. I don't even think we had flour scoops yet. We're using a little bucket, see, mm-hmm. and just filling up the main buckets and then putting them down in the fish hold. And I got a hold of my friend Floyd, who recognized the lack of communications early on, had repositioned his longliner in the middle of Prince William Sound and was acting as an unofficial VHF radio relay station, transferring all one. You know, he positioned himself so he could pick up Valdez, and then from there he could relay to most of the other parties in Prince William Sound. And I did that for several days until Alascom got a communications relay station set up on Bly Island, which happened. Alascom also did a very good job of their part of the Alyeska response plan. North Slope, the three things that went right were Bill Deppe lightering the Exxon Valdez, thank God that they had professionals doing that. And North Slope responded immediately and brought us, you know, it wasn't, they didn't make a material difference except for bringing a much needed stash of boom to Prince William Sound. And so that was a resource that the fishermen could use from then on. We had to go up and drag it off the beach and put it to good use. And believe me, we did. And the third thing was Alascom Communications that showed up and built a radio relay station on Bligh Island and solved a lot of the communication problems. Didn't solve them, but at least got people talking to each other, thank God. And those three things worked. Nothing else worked. But in any case, Floyd, once Floyd got relieved of his vital communications thing, by that time he was a famous guy with Exxon Logistics, so he moved into the plush offices of Exxon Valdez, of the Exxon Logistics in Valdez, and he was doing the best he could to give a little bit of reality to those Texans, you know, And so, on my first bucketeering trip, I managed to get a hold of him on a secret radio we had. And I told him, I said, get a hold of your boss in Exxon and tell him that I'm coming to town with 100 buckets of oil and I expect to get paid for these buckets. And we'll negotiate a price at the dock. And if I don't like the price, we're going to have a Valdez tea party. By that time, the whole world's media, this is 2 weeks into the spill, everybody was there. Rolling Stone famously was there. And I made the yearbook in Rolling Stone. That's my claim to fame, is that you can make more money working for other skippers, but I'm the only skipper who got his crew mentioned by name in Rolling Stone. So, you want fame or fortune, boys?
Yeah. I hear you. That about tops things out in a person's life. Yeah, my son. Back on.
It's an 89 yearbook. It's 40 or 50 pages. And they treat me real well, but every fact about me in there is wrong. So it was simultaneously real good.
Okay, this is the yearbook for December 14 to 28, 1989, special double issue of the Rolling Stone.
Yeah, it's a very good story. The guy was just in a hurry the night I met him, and he got the facts on me all wrong. But anyway, the majority of the story is very well done.
So
where were we? We were...
you were telling me...
We bucketeered for two or three days and then got the 100 buckets filled up and my crew quit me in disgust. They couldn't handle it anymore.
And why is that?
Because it's nasty work.
Oh, yeah.
And right. We were, of course, being illegal. I mean, we were being buzzed by helicopters with megaphones telling us to immediately cease and desist. We were breaking federal law. We'd never be able to enter a port again. Blah, 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 blah. You know, all this shit. They didn't want anybody out there, you know. Coast Guard's only position was, we don't need any help. Stay the hell away. You know.
And how big was your crew?
Two.
Just the three of you. Yeah.
Yeah. But they were, you know, things were... Kathy had to fly back to Cordova. She had two young kids. I mean, back to Anchorage, Seattle. She had two young kids down there. And Mike was... Mike stuck around for a while. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I lost my crew after two or three days, and we had the buckets filled anyway, so I dropped them off and ran up to Valdez to have the Valdez tea party, because I had no indications that there was going to be any welcome mat rolled out, you know. But by God, I got up there, and they were just setting up the vessel decamp. The first thing they did was set up a decontamination thing. It was like, the odd thing was that one of the many things that happened was that we started treating spilled oil like it was radioactive. I mean, it is very low-level radioactive, but we treated it like it was made out of plutonium.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like, oh my God, keep that shit away from me, you know? And it just became the liquid of the devil, you know?
Right.
And so the first priority was to set up these fancy decontamination centers outside of the Federal Harbor, where you had to go through this sanitization process before you could enter the harbor. And I wasn't in a mood, so I stormed right past it and tied up to the end of the transit float. And I talked with Floyd that day, and they knew I was imminently due, and I was not looking for any delays. Something was going to happen that afternoon. You know, they were going to hand over a big wad of money, or I was going to dump this shit into Valdez Harbor and take my chances, you know, with the media.
Yeah.
And by God, I pulled up to the end of the transit float, and the head of Exxon Logistics was there to meet me, along with Floyd. And his first words out of his mouth were, "We're buying it. Do not throw anything in the water. We are purchasing this oil from you." I said, "Okay, now you're talking. Let's negotiate." And I wanted $100 a bucket, which is what the kelp would have been worth, that I would have much preferred to have filled these buckets up with. So, you know, $100 a bucket. And of course, the Exxon guy was just, "Oh, God, it's not worth nearly that much." Not worth nearly that much. And I said, "Well, A, it's no longer oil. It's toxic waste. It has negative value. And I'll tell you what, if you want to do another avenue, if you get a lawyer down here, I'll sign a document saying I just want to be paid the average amount that you spend to pick up a gallon of oil. I'll take the average." You know, which is what, several $1,000 a gallon so far, boys? You know, yeah. This is bargain oil. This is cheap oil, $100 a bucket, you know. So we hammered and hawed down there at the end of the dock for a while, and I settled for $20 a bucket and a half contract, which they were finally starting to do right this time. Everything was finally starting to happen. The logjam was breaking, and there were contracts being let to fishermen to go out and do various projects, and including starting to use these Navy skimmers. The Navy skimmers needed two boats apiece to tow them. They weren't self-propelled, and of course Exxon had nothing. So it's come down to, guess what? The only boats around are commercial fishing boats, guys. Thousands of them, you know. So we got pressed into service finally, and at the height of the response, there were over 1,100 commercial fishing boats engaged in the response. You know, and the current plan that I'm reviewing right now, the new 2007 plan, incorporates over 700 fishing boats in the response. Half of them pre-trained, half of them trained once the oil's on the water. Mm-hmm. Over 300 boats will respond within the first 72 hours, and then another 400 boats are needed to fill out the response plan over the first 2 weeks. So it's night and day today on this. The backbone of the Prince William Sound response is commercial fishing boats that go through an annual training cycle. It's like being in the National Guard in the old days. For everyone, and they make enough money being trained every year to pay their harbor fees, basically. So it's a good program, and everyone relies on it. It's going to work.
Great.
I'm very faithful. If we ever, on the odd chance we ever have to use it, it'll be very, very successful. And I tell Exxon, don't you dare spill any more oil in Prince William Sound, because we'll set a new standard for cleanup. You know, we'll shock the world with the amount of oil we give back to the oil company that dares to have another Exxon Valdez.
So, and that was going to be my question, is what makes you say the odd chance? I mean, considering there aren't double hulls on the tankers yet, are there?
There are. Everyone but Exxon. Exxon's the bottom feeder. One of the things that took a long time to learn was that, and one of the stories you should tell in this book that hasn't been told, is the 1993 blockade of Valdez Narrows.
That's
by the commercial fishermen. A very successful operation. And I was there for that. And we could talk about that later on today if you want. But what got me on that?
Exxon bottom feeder.
Oh, yeah. At that time, we shut down we had a dispute with Exxon, of course, over, it had been 5 years, and we were still not seeing any money from them for civil damages. And more more to the leadership I'll go into that later. But in any case, during the blockade, we didn't differentiate between the oil companies. Mm-hmm. They all were in league with each other. A famous story was that British Petroleum gave Exxon oil during the oil spill so that they could keep their stations running down here on the West Coast, that there was a big transfer of oil from British Petroleum to Exxon so that the Exxon boys wouldn't have to close their stations down since they weren't getting any oil. And that sort of was our position on the various oil companies. They're all in league with each other. You know, it's them or us. So during that blockade, we didn't differentiate between Exxon and the rest of the oil tankers. And it became a famous dispute right away during the blockade because British Petroleum was aghast. They said, "What are you talking about? You think we are in league with Exxon? Exxon is our biggest enemy." And from that, that was about the time I came to realize that they were saying that British Petroleum, for once, was not speaking with a forked tongue. That in fact, it's true. They will go out of their way. And British Petroleum that day, during the blockade, went out of its way to embarrass Exxon, using us as their tool. They actually sent one of their tankers in to break our blockade on television. You know, Exxon, of course, wouldn't be caught in the same frame as this man. They were 50 miles away. You know, they weren't going to give us a moment, you know, but British Petroleum gave us the moment because they were so outraged that they were having, again, to pay a penalty for Exxon's bottom feeding. Exxon is a famous bottom feeder. It's the worst of all the oil companies by a huge league. And one of the many things they did was this double hull thing. Mm-hmm. We got double hulls in Open 90. That's an interesting story, how we did that. But if the rules were clear, you had about 15 years to change your single hull tankers out for modern double hull tankers, and all of the oil companies, save Exxon, have done that. They've gone beyond the requirements of Open 90. They built their tankers ahead of time. They put redundant systems throughout them. They built a modern fleet of state-of-the-art oil tankers that are much, much safer inherently than the single-hull tankers like Exxon Valdez. And all but Exxon. Exxon stalled and stalled and tried to get out of it, and they finally managed to get an amendment into the Patriot Act. When they were running out of time, they'd reached the point where they had to commit to building these things, or they were not going to make their Open 90 deadlines. They were going to have to cease operations in Alaska, with the tankers they were using, and so they got a thing in the Patriot Act saying, "Well, now that we're at war, the Navy needs priority in all of the boatyards around the country and stuff, and so we just can't be building any more tankers right now." So Exxon got a 2-year moratorium on the rules, you know, which people figure they made about $100 million in profit by that move, assuming they had to pay some of our fabulous legislators a few million dollars in bribes. But the cost of being able to delay their double hull construction for an additional 2 years made them something like $100 million against Chevron and British Petroleum and ConocoPhillips, who had all done the right thing. And once again, Exxon walks away laughing. You know, they haven't learned a single lesson except that being the bad boy makes them the biggest corporation in the world. You know, and they're teaching it all, of course, to Walmart, who's their rival. So don't expect anything good to come out of Walmart. Being a good guy does not pay in capitalism. Being the bottom feeder pays. You know, and British Petroleum spent a little period here trying to emulate them, which has come to an end, thank God, I think. You know. They allowed the North Slope stuff to go completely to hell over our... It's not our jurisdiction, the North Slope. RCAC has no jurisdiction on the pipeline or up north. But we had been cast... We know enough to have been very worried about the situation up there, and we've been telling the state and the federal government for years about it, and to no avail. And now it's finally come home to roost for everyone. But But that's a great example of the need of an RCAC. The people, the problem is it's not a populated enough area, but the natives have been very effective on RCAC, and I'm sure they can be on the North Slope as well. We need a local citizens advisory group, federally mandated, industry paid for, on the pipeline in the North Slope to keep this stuff from happening, because the state will not do its job if it doesn't have citizens, well-informed, well-paid staff working for local citizens, hanging over their shoulders saying, look at here, looky here, you're not doing your job. You know, do we have to go to the newspapers? What do we have to do? Get you to do your job. That's what we have. That's our job. That's what RCAC does. It threatens the state and the federal government with embarrassment if they don't do their job. Mm-hmm. And we make sure everybody knows about it. And it's very effective. Over the years, it's very effective. Mm-hmm. And that's what the North Slope and the pipeline need as well. And I hope it happens. There's a push for it, but, you know.
So you, when you keep speaking of RCAC in plural, so you're obviously on the board of directors.
I was on the board of directors. Uh-huh. I've retired.
Since the spill, or when did you take office?
Well, I was one of the 50 fishermen who went back to D.C. in the summer of 1989 to protest the lack of any federal oil spill legislation and the fact that the Coast Guard didn't feel responsible for protecting the citizens of Prince William Sound. That, the story for Alaskans, especially for Prince William Sound and downstream communities, is the inaction of the federal government. Sound familiar? I mean, it was just like Katrina, only 20 years earlier, you know? And in fact, in Katrina, was not nearly as bad, because in Katrina, eventually, the feds fessed up after several days. And yes, in fact, they did have some responsibilities here, you know. The Coast Guard never did. During Exxon Valdez, the federal government never admitted it had any responsibilities below the office of the president. You know, finally, George Bush said, hey, I guess I have to take control here and force the government to do something. And he did, you know, to his credit. And 2 weeks late, but, you know, he did. Or we'd have never got those Navy skimmers, which were the backbone of the skimming operations that collected somewhere between 6 and 15% of the oil, depending on who you believe. But it was 6 to 15% of the oil that did not impregnate the gravels of Prince William Sound. You know, we can be thankful for that. And it was at least something. It was not so much that... People don't understand, you know, people just say, well, boy, a massive oil spill like that, you just can't really do anything, you know. And, well, the hell you can't, you know. And not only that, you need to do something, and not just for the environment. You need to do it so you can live with yourself, you know. I mean, the whole town of Cordova went nuts during those 2 weeks. It was not a healthy community at the end of those first 2 weeks, man, because we were pissed. We were pissed and impotent and constrained, and we were not a bunch of happy campers, you know, and people have not gotten over it. You know, people like myself and Bill Black and numerous people in Cordova have not gotten over it. You go to Cordova, you'll get I can't imagine writing a story of the oil spill without visiting Cordova.
Oh, right.
You know, and I could give you some names of interesting people to talk to there if you want. But it was, you know, I had to get out of there. And this bucketeering thing was desperation. You know, you had to do something. You just had to do something. This was not going to be able to go down like that. It was not business as usual, you know. Mm-hmm. And it drove us out of town, and we did this. We were at risk. We were breaking every federal law known to man out here on this bucketeering stuff, you know. But we got legitimized at the time down on the end of the dock, where I took $20 a bucket and half a daily contract. We got a 50% contract, so we would be covered by all the, you know, legalese. And so I was getting $1,700 a day instead of $3,500, and then $20 a bucket. And they limited me. They were terrified that I had a billion gallons locked up somewhere, and was just in 100 guys ready to do these buckets, and, you know, was going to whack them for several million dollars. So they put me on a limit of I forget what it was, 200 buckets a day. There was no minimum, of course. They didn't want any of this stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's the point you have to make again and again. The problem with having the responsible party in charge of the cleanup is that oil has negative value once it hits the water. It's toxic waste. And the more oil you recover, the more money you have to spend. You know, that, and Exxon has made this point several times. They're fairly candid guys, Exxon villains are. You know, they'll talk the truth at you once in a while. And what they say is, why should we pick it up? Why should we pick it up? We're going to be sued by everybody under God's creation. You know, the maximum fines are going to be levied against us, you know, in a major spill like this. There's no way we're going to get a substantial percentage of it. You know, their position is 10 or 20% is all you're ever going to get anyway, you know, which is wrong. But that's their position, and they've got the government believing it. So why should we pick any of it up? Because then we have to store it. It's toxic waste. You know where all of the 6 to 15% we did recover in Exxon Valdez is today? Be an interesting little sidelight. Go visit the oil. It's sitting out in eastern Oregon in a landfill. You know, my buckets are out there. All of the other stuff, huge containers full of Exxon Valdez crude oil and sea otters and, you know, whatever else they bucket it up, is sitting out in eastern Oregon, trucked down the Alcan. Trucked down the Alcan to eastern Oregon and put in a landfill is where it is.
Oh,
now, that would be
God.
An interesting picture, wouldn't it? You know, and it's costing Exxon money to this day to pay its storage fees on that stuff.
That's a dirty
little
secret.
Why would they want it back? Why would they want it back? You know, where's the upside for them? That's what they keep saying. Where's the upside?
Yeah.
Where's the upside? And I keep saying, well, eventually you come down and say, it's your moral duty.
Yeah.
And they say, well, we're doing
What's
it, aren't we?
Moral
we're
duty? What's
we're
that?
Out there. We're out there. We're morally doing it. We just don't, there's not a lot of, it's not like we're finding new oil. Now, boy, we can really focus on finding new oil. You know?
That's our moral obligation.
And that's why the government has to be in charge. There's just no upside for the spiller. There's no upside. I mean, the fines and stuff are minuscule, of course, because they're based on small harbor spills and stuff. So even ratcheted up to 25 million gallons, they don't amount to, you know, an hour's profit for Exxon. So, you know, there's no impetus for them to do anything until the Bush said, oh, yes, you will, you know.
So, Tom, tell me what it was like when you got back to Cordova after having dealt with the Exxon people.
I didn't go back.
Oh.
I didn't go back. I went back out on several
you just went to work.
Subsequent bucketeering expeditions. And by this time, fishermen were being drafted in huge numbers. Boats were, the feds had reversed their no leaving the ports thing. And fishermen were being, hundreds of boats were being hired by Exxon. This is, right as I did that first bucketeering expedition, that's when Bush told Exxon to get on the stick,
mm-hmm.
and told the Coast Guard to get on the stick, and told the Navy to send everything they could send.
Mm-hmm.
And all of this happened within, finally, very few days. It should have happened 2 weeks earlier,
mm-hmm.
but when the oil was still there, you know, and pick-upable and stuff, but it happened 2 weeks later. But from the next few days after that, were marvelous change. We didn't, you know, it's amazing how much you can get done in 4 or 5 days once you all get lined up and decide you're going to do it.
Right.
You know, and the boom and the skimmers show up, and the various barges have come up from Valdez, and the fishermen were released, you know, to go do it, and there were people having fist fights in the lines to get hired by Exxon, and. You know, the rush was on, right? Get to Valdez, don't be late, you know? And a lesson was burned into the commercial fishing community, the fishing boats. It was still before the season. People were scattered. There were hundreds of people in Hawaii, you know? There were people in Washington State. There were people all over still enjoying our winter times activities, you know? And people responded at various degrees of urgency, coming back up and getting their boat ready to go. Because the first 2 weeks, it was like we had no role to play. So the first word out as these guys checked in from Hawaii was, there's nothing for you to do, man. They won't let us go out of the harbor. They won't let us do anything, right? So people hung out in Hawaii, you know, kept on surfing, and were late. They were late. And boy, the guys who were there panting, ready to go, made a lot more money on the cleanup than the guys who waited until they got the word that there was big money getting made by the locals before they got up there.
Yeah.
And boy, I mean, that lesson will take generations to forget. Mm-hmm. Let me tell you, no one is going to be late again.
Yeah.
Never, you know. It was the biggest paycheck in Prince William Sound for a number of years. And, you know, and you got to be truthful about that, too. A lot of people right. turned into spillionaires.
Right. Now, I want to ask you this. As a self-proclaimed outsider, this is the question I intend to ask more people than just yourself, but being staying home with a couple of little kids, my husband is a school teacher, back in the spring of 89, I didn't have too much of a concept of what's going on, didn't have any connection with the fishing community or anything maritime. But I keep hearing this term spillionaire and, you know, knowing that people were I had an awareness, and certainly I read the newspaper and watched it on television. But over the years, I have known that there was this this flashpoint between certain people who were involved in the cleanup and ongoing animosity about it. And I'm beginning to glean what that is about. But I would like to hear your impression as an as the self-proclaimed outsider, which is to say that you
I don't think there was an insider-outsider thing on
okay.
the spillionaire deal. A lot of non-residents became spillionaires.
Well, no, what I mean to say is that in the community of Houma, we have people who literally live side by side. And people who turn their vessels into part of the cleanup effort and worked for Exxon. Okay, then I should narrow that down and say people who bought several other vessels, who saw their opportunity. And
I may not be the smartest guy. There was a famous non-resident in Cordoba who was the refrigeration guy. He came up every summer and worked on refrigeration systems for all the boats and stuff. He was not a fisherman himself. He was a refrigeration guy.
Mm-hmm.
But he was... he was a character, and he happened to be pals. Just at this same time, they set up the Vico came to town, and hired some Anchorage guy to come down and represent Vico Engineering, and they were the party that was contracting the fishing boats and stuff. They were the money tentacle of Exxon in Cordoba, the Vico office. And that's where you went to get signed up and, you know, become a spillionaire, was the Vico office. And this guy happened to be a friend. This guy who was running the Vico office happened to be an old acquaintance of the refrigeration guy.